Before we get into today's episode, which we recorded live in Miami, we have one order of Waves business. We are hosting another Is It Sexist call-in show before the end of the year. So if you have an Is It Sexist question you would like us to answer, please leave us a message at 646-907-9859. Again, the number is 646-907-9859. All right, on to the show.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to The Waves for Thursday, November 22nd. Woo! I'm Christina Cotarucci, a staff writer at Slate and host of the Slate podcast Outward. Here with me in beautiful Miami, Florida, recording live at the Miami Book Fair, is Hannah Rosin.
Hi.
Host of NPR's Invisibilia. And we also have New York Magazine's Noreen Malone. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, how are you?
It was Noreen's first time in Miami.
I love it. I want to stay for a lot longer than I'm supposed to.
So do I. I actually feel like these chairs are what I would think of as like Miami furniture in my dream Miami, like lanai or something like that. So today we're going to start off talking about Sheryl Sandberg. Not sure if you've heard of her, the Facebook CEO and Lean In author whose dubious political dealings were the subject of a major New York Times investigation that came out this week. Then we are going to chat with Celeste Ng. I'm so excited. We're going to talk about her wonderful novel, Little Fires Everywhere, among other things. And finally, we are going to welcome Rebecca Traister to the mic to talk about her new book, Good and Mad, which is an exploration of the righteous power of women's anger. But we're especially excited for our Slate Plus segment today, where we are going to be taking Is It Sexist questions from the audience. So you will have the entire episode to think about things that you think may or may not be sexist. You'll come up to the mic right in the middle, and we will make a scientific judgment on whether they are or are not sexist. So be mulling that over as you're listening. If something sexist happens to you during this show, please bring it to the mic. All right, should we get into it?
Let's do it.
What if they ask if one of us is sexist?
We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Yeah. It's never happened at a live show, but we're in Miami, and what happens in Miami stays in Miami, I guess.
I think you want people to ask if you're sexist. I think you're kind of tempting it.
Yeah. You can also ask that if you'd like, Hannah. So Sheryl Sandberg, she became a household name in 2013 with her Empowerment Feminism Manifesto Lean In. This week, I'm not sure if y'all read this big New York Times expose on how Facebook has dealt with Russian interference in U.S. elections, other political challenges. And Sandberg came out looking like something of a villainous mastermind of this profoundly unethical corporate operation. She used a conservative Oppo research firm to smear Facebook critics as George Soros-funded protesters, then turn around and said that those protesters were anti-Semitic. She tried to minimize the extent to which Russian operatives had used Facebook to get disinformation in front of users. And she worried that Republicans would be angrier at Facebook if they revealed the many pages that Russia had put up, these pro-Trump Facebook pages. So I want to know what you guys think about these revelations, but I would especially like to think about how we think of them in relation to Lean In and how she's positioned herself as this sort of crusader for women's equality in tech and the idea that businesses will be better if women occupy half of the...
You know, so as you were giving your introduction, the thing that caught me was your use of the word villainous, because as I was reading this New York
Times... Is it sexist?
Maybe. But yes, I'll ask that question when we get to that segment, if Christina was sexist, but in her introduction. But the thing that struck me as I was reading this entire long New York Times expose, which you should read, was, am I surprised? And if I'm surprised, why? Hmm. Like, she runs, you know, one of the biggest companies in America. What she did was utterly standard capitalist. Like, utterly standard capitalist, like take down your competitors, you know, in pretty insidious ways, you know, put profits before decency and civic duty, try to hide or actually delay, I shouldn't say hide, that's unfair, try to delay the exposing of things that were going to get her company in trouble. Is this villainous, or is this just something that a capitalist, like someone who's a capitalist, does every day? And so then the natural next question is, you know, are feminism of a certain kind and capitalism of a certain kind compatible or not?
Well, this has always been baked into her philosophy, right? Like, Lean In was never about structural changes for women. It was about basically how can you operate as men do in the workplace. That was really what it was, right? And it was, you know, she gave all of these interviews where she said, well, we could focus on the people who are holding us back, but that would, what good would that do? It's more positive to focus on what we can do to change it.
But positive, like all we focused on was the positive stuff. It's like, take a seat at the table. Like, it was just like, it was so, the ethos around Sheryl Sandberg for so many years was like, you go, girl.
From most people, not entirely. From the very beginning, there were people sort of criticizing the capitalist feminist mashup, saying that actually, like, is what we want from our feminist heroes telling us how to more effectively spend more of our lives at work, right? And you know, from the very beginning, this was baked into the philosophy. I'm not surprised at all. A, because this is actually like not so different from what she was saying in Lean In, and B, because even before Lean In came out, she had hired a fancy PR firm to smear Google. She had, you know, actually like really ruffled a lot of feathers when she left Google to come to Facebook. She hired away executives in this way that was just totally against the normal practices. She was ruthless from the very beginning, but you know, I think a lot of people were hungry for someone who would give them an individual playbook for how to operate at work. I mean, that's what I've been thinking about, is like, okay, I've kind of always not been a Sheryl Sandberg fan. At the same time, this has always rubbed me the wrong way. It seemed fake. It seemed like, you know, I don't want to be the executive of a company. And there were certain things that she was advocating that just seemed so foreign to like being a human being and operating in the workplace, like as not an automaton, actually.
And also just ignoring the fact that if you actually want more women to succeed, you can't just tell them to do things like lean in and get up at 5 a.m. to check their emails. You have to address the things that are holding them back too, which involves, I think, some kind of cross-class solidarity. And it's not just going to happen from, you know, the women at the upper echelons telling people below them what to do.
But do we want more women to have power?
Yes.
But Hannah, so I want to say, is this what having more power looks like? Like the ideal world in which women get to have more power, but they behave absolutely like benevolent socialists, is like, is that realistic? Is that like a realistic?
That is a great question. And to your initial question about is it villainous or is it just capitalist, I want to say those two things are not mutually exclusive, and that potentially the fact that it is the way capitalism operates makes it even more villainous and pervasive. But I think I, you know, have written plenty of articles about like, oh, people who want more women on corporate boards and the great things that happen when there's gender equity at the top. And it's, you know, more good governance, less fraud, like all the things you want an ethical company to do. But I'm starting to think that that's not the argument we want to make, because that's basically saying, you know, obviously it's true, and if it's true, we should say it, but it's saying that, like, women have something, some innate quality that makes them more ethical leaders. And then when we turn around and have a Sheryl Sandberg, it becomes like, oh, what does this say about women's leadership? And I think the fact that she made herself this icon of corporate feminism the rest of us a little bit of a disservice, because now we're forced to place her within the context of feminism, where I don't think she really belonged in the first place.
Interesting. Although she put herself there. It's not like we fakely put her there. She was
perceived,
and maybe by many people in this audience, and we'll hear in the question and answer session, as like an inspiration. I mean, right? I see people nodding in the audience. There are many people nodding in the audience.
And some shaking heads.
Yes, and shaking heads. Sheryl Sandberg was an inspiration. I remember, like, I do a lot of home exchanges, and I remember twice in home exchanges with my family, I opened the closet door of the woman's house who I was staying in.
What's a home exchange?
Home exchange is like you switch houses with people.
You do that just for fun?
Yeah.
Huh.
So, wow. But like in a different city. Like they take their house. It's free and, you know, we get a car and everything. Anyway, it's a good way to travel. So in two closets of the women who I was doing home exchange, they had cut out lean-in. This was in the height of the lean-in years and had them there as like their points of inspiration from Cheryl.
Whoa.
She's sincerely like inspirational to many, many, many women. And so...
Well, it's self-help, right? And it's self-help using the language of feminism. And so when most people go into the workplace, they're not thinking, how today can I make things structurally better for women? Like it just, you're trying to get through the day, you're trying to do better for yourself. Like you're trying not to be a jerk. You're maybe trying on an individual level to mentor people in your office or just be quietly, you know, a good force for women in your office, but you're probably not going to be able to solve like feminism in your own office and certainly not across the country.
But why not?
Well,
like if you're going to spend your capital in the office, should you spend your capital kind of positioning yourself as we have just seen her do? Like there's one interpretation of what she's done if you read the details of this article, which is like protect her status, protect the kind of profits of that company. Is that how you should spend your capital? Or could you possibly spend your capital like petitioning your boss to have, you know, slightly more generous work life? I don't know. There's lots of ways to spend your capital in a workplace.
You could, but let's say you're, you know, 33 years old, you want to get promoted at work, and you become the person who's complaining about women's benefits day in, day out. You might not get promoted, right?
But because that's the structure you're in, where the people at the top are not going to think kindly on...
Totally. I'm just trying to, like, explain the appeal of it. If you are operating in the world, even if you, you know, care about the cause and think of it as a cause, it just might not be as applicable to your daily life as like thinking about how mentorship happens and thinking about, you know, what are the men doing in this office that I am not doing.
So is the conclusion of this conversation that feminism defined as individual self-empowerment is a mistake?
Well, I think that's sort of like a category error, right? Like, feminism is like a movement of solidarity, I think. And so it's sort of difficult to say that individual self-empowerment is feminism. It can operate within feminism, but I don't think that it's a stand-in for feminism.
I think it matters also what you're being empowered to do. And I think the title of her movement, Lean In, doesn't tell us what we're supposed to be leaning into. And I think she's leaned into some really unsavory practices that are destabilizing democracy and, you know, bad for women in the end. And I think Facebook would have been a feminist company had she acted differently. But I think there's a certain, when you're talking about being cutthroat in your own life, and that's, I think it's an easy step to then let that trickle into, you know, how you're operating your business. And I'm also curious whether people who are fans of Sheryl Sandberg, who've cut out Lean In and put it in their closet every morning, will be inclined to defend her, will be disillusioned by these revelations, or whether, you know, she's just another leader of another company and that's the way they do things.
Yeah, disillusioned. I think people will be super disillusioned.
Really?
Yes.
I think some people might just say like,
this is what you do.
Yeah. Like you guys are being naive. She's one of the most powerful business women ever, pretty much in America, with a tremendous amount of power. And what do we expect? I mean, just to turn this a little bit, like I think that one possible interpretation of both that New York Times article and this conversation is that it's a little bit sexist and that we are putting women in a trap by being surprised, you know, when they have a tremendous amount of power and are put in a situation where they have to defend their company, and then they do just that. And so there's always this pressure on, you know, because the way that New York Times article unfolded, she was the mommy and he was the baby. Like,
yeah.
Honestly, like, she's the mommy and she made all the decisions and she was all prepared, and he was like, I don't know, like, ask mommy the question, you
yeah,
know, like,
I prefer
that's
to
it's
just
his
code.
Damn company. Mm-hmm. So, like, so, but that's not the way, like, we rolled out the story. It was like, well, she's a woman and she has a certain ethical responsibility that he doesn't have. And so we kind of like, I don't know. It's like what we did.
I don't think she has a specific ethical responsibility, but I think because she has this whole other side of her persona, which is about how women should conduct themselves in the workplace, mm-hmm. we're forced to interpret her actions as something bigger than just what she did, which is kind of ironic because her whole thing is like, oh, just do what's right for you. And, you know, she does have a lot to say about mentorship and, you know, women have created lean-in circles where they mentor each other and share their experiences. So I don't want to say it's just about her, but I think there's like a little bit of a blind spot in terms of how she, like a willful blind spot in terms of how her actions affect other people.
Can I say a word about lean-in circles?
Have you been to a lean-in circle?
No, but
Have you been to one?
I really have not. But
how many people have been to a lean-in circle?
They're not in vogue anymore. But I think instead of, as an alternative to having a lean-in circle, this is what I've done at work. Ask your male friends how they would go about asking for a raise. Like, ask them how they would conduct themselves in a situation, and I find that so much more helpful. It's like, it's just getting, you know, it's your eyes are opened. You're like, oh no, they don't feel bad about this at all. It's just like, if you're gonna actually copy the men, like, actually copy the men.
Yeah, it's that, like, Lord, give me the confidence of a mediocre white man. There's literally, I suggest that everyone do this. Pick a literal person in your workplace. I have someone in my workplace. He doesn't know who he is. Who I literally, before I go to ask for a raise or advocate for myself in some way, I think, what would this person do? And I become a little more confident when I think about that. But I could also just ask him. You're right, Noreen.
But now you can't.
You're right. I mean, what you were saying, Hannah... And I do think that the New York Times article was written a little bit this way, so I'm not sure how much was the writer's decision and how much is just the truth, or how much is the way their sources interpret things. But I, you know, are we treating her with a harsher... Are we treating her more harshly than Mark Zuckerberg because she's a woman? I feel as angry with him as I do with her,
well,
I think.
The person, if you go into the article, the person to be really mad at is Joel Kaplan, who is making a lot of the decisions alongside Sheryl Sandberg.
But and who hired him?
What's that?
Who hired him? Didn't Sheryl Sandberg?
Sheryl Sandberg, yeah. Right. So I think, yes, there probably is an element of sexism to the way that Zuckerberg is allowed to be a child at 34 and, like, Sandberg was hired at 38 to be the adult in the room. There's not that much difference between those ages. But, like, her job is to be the manager of the company. Like, this does all fall under her purview. He did, in part, hire her because he knew he was bad at this kind of stuff. And she did what she was supposed to do pretty effectively. I mean, it seems like she was actually kind of checked out at certain points when she was promoting another book. But, like, if what she was supposed to do was to... was to prevent this all happening for a while, she held it off. And she, you know, she went to Congress, she wrote thank you notes for every congressman. She was very prepared.
Would you consider that emotional labor?
You'd have to
use a buzzy phrase.
I think she sees that as, I mean, that is part of what makes her so good, right? Like, there's no evidence, at least as far as I can tell, that she's, like, super charming or funny, but she's very sort of correct in the way that she approaches people. She probably always remembers everyone's name, you know, she knows what their pet issues are. She's, like, prepped for the thing, which isn't in and of itself kind of a, you know, gendered kind of stereotype, but, like, that is her approach.
Well, and she travels with an entourage of 10 or 12 people, the article said. So, you know, it's possible one of them is whispering in her ear.
Like
a la Veep.
Like Veep, yeah.
Yeah. All right, I think that's all the time we have for Sheryl Sandberg. I'm really curious to hear from our listeners if there's any people who are involved in lean-in circles or fans of hers and what they think. So if you're listening and you have thoughts, email us at thewaves@slate.com. Next up, We are so excited to welcome Celeste Ng to the show. She's the author of the 2014 novel, Everything I Never Told You. Her second and most recent novel, Little Fires Everywhere, came out in 2017. I recommended it on the show a few weeks back. It's a brilliant book. So please welcome to the waves, Celeste Ng. Woo! Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Hi.
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 So we read your book. I loved your book. And I love, in particular, the way you write about motherhood in the book. One of my favorite plot lines in the novel is the one about this young Chinese immigrant who gives birth to a baby girl, and because she's living in poverty and depressed and, you know, any number of factors, she leaves the baby at a fire station, a white couple tries to adopt the baby, she takes them to court. One of the things I love best about that plot line is my sympathies were drawn in multiple directions, and there didn't seem to be an easy answer to these questions. How do you think about those questions, and how do you engage your readers' sympathies in those ways?
Well, I'm glad you said that your sympathies were pulled in different ways, because that was really what I wanted. I have an 8-year-old now. When I was writing the book, he was about 5, and he was really in this phase with his friends about talking about who the good guys are and the bad guys are when they play at recess, when they're watching Star Wars stuff. You know, do you want to be the good guy? Do you want to be the bad guy? And I felt it was really important to talk to him about the idea that that bad guys don't always think that they are the bad guys, that bad guys generally think that they are the good guys, and they think that what they're doing is important and necessary and right. And it doesn't mean that it is, but it means that we have to kind of understand how they're seeing the world in order to understand why they would do these things. And so when I wrote this book, I really didn't want there to be a villain, and I wanted it to be complicated. You asked sort of about how I see this and how I engage readers with this. My answer to that is basically that I don't think I have answers for this, but I wanted to raise all those questions. I wanted to make people think, oh, well, maybe this person has a point here, but maybe this person has a point there. I wanted it to be really complicated.
You know, the other two moms I thought about a lot too, because one represents kind of order, Shaker Heights order, everything in its place. She's not the worst. Like, she's a journalist. You know, she has sort of cultivated curiosity. I guess in America that does make her the worst these days, but in my eyes, not the worst, you know, but she's not like a Stepford wifey character. She's sort of likable and has wonderful children and all that. But there is a kind of, one is chaos, one is free spirit, and free spirit pays a price, and chaos mom, order mom pays a price, and free spirit mom pays a price. And I've thought a lot about, like, as a writer, you know, as a writer slash mother, do you think of them as a stark archetype of mother, as like all mothers are split between those two instincts? Because they were extreme in the book.
Yeah, I think one of the jobs of the writer is to kind of take a real life situation and dial it up to 11, so to speak, because that's sort of when we start to see the contrast. But I really think of them as being flip sides of the same coin. I mean, people have asked me a lot, you know, okay, so which mother are you? Are you Mia or are you Mrs. Richardson? And the answer is that I'm really kind of both in some ways. Like, I am like an order Muppet myself. Like, I really like things being in order. I don't like it when there's not a plan. You know, I don't like unexpected surprises. But I also think of myself as a creative person, and I want to be flexible. And I think that's sort of the dichotomy that, like, most people, maybe, but especially most women, I think, have to kind of manage, especially if they become parents, of sort of saying, how much do I enforce the rules and how much am I trying to sort of break those rules or change those rules or expand the space that I'm living in or expand the space that my children have. So for me, they're sort of like a Mobius strip. Like, it just goes, if you follow it all the way around, you kind of come out the other side. And I heard from a lot of readers that they think Elena Richardson is sort of like this, she's getting everything wrong and she's so rigid, but Mia's rigid in her own way.
Yeah.
I mean, she kind of takes a hard line in not ever setting down roots and in not ever focusing on something.
Sorry, for readers who have not yet read your book, can you just give like a 2-sentence summary? And then I want to ask you, so Celeste and I are from the same hometown, actually, and the book is set.
Oh, wow.
Her older sister was in my class. So
I didn't realize.
We discovered this like well after the thing.
And then I wanted to ask you about the setting, about Shaker Heights, and why you chose to set it there, probably because you're from there, but what you thought set up the political or identity themes in Shaker.
Yeah, so let me give you the two-sentence sum up of the book and then ask me your question again. So the book takes place in Shaker Heights, Ohio, which is a suburb of Cleveland. It's where I grew up and where Noreen grew up and many other people, but it's a pretty small town. And it was a really great place to grow up. It's very progressive, generally speaking. It really focused a lot on racial diversity. It was one of the reasons that my parents moved there. When I was in high school, I think it was almost 50-50 black and white. And for comparison, the town to the east was like 93% white and 7% non-white, and the town directly to the south was like 97% black and like 93% white, I guess. And it was really unusual for that, and that we talked a lot about race. One of the families that lives in this town, the Richardsons, are at the heart of the book. The mother is the journalist we talked about, the father's a lawyer, and they've got four kids. They're sort of this archetypal sort of nuclear family. And a single mother and her teenage daughter come to town. This is Mia Warren and her daughter Pearl. And they move around a lot. They're not in the most stable of professions. They're really sort of at odds with the community and with the family. And these two families sort of get mixed up with each other. When the town is split over an adoption battle. This Asian American baby is being adopted by a white couple, and these two moms, Mia and Elena Richardson, find themselves on opposite sides. And that's when all these sort of secrets and conflicts start to come out.
And so I was particularly interested in sort of the blind spots that you saw in Shaker, where, as you said, we talked so much when we were growing up about the value of diversity and what that could bring, but you know, just talking about it is an imperfect thing, obviously.
Yeah. So Shaker Heights makes a really conscious effort to talk about issues of race. And it's something that I didn't appreciate until after I'd moved away. I went to college and people said, wait, you had a race relations group at your high school? And I said, yeah, it was kind of like the cool club to join in some ways. Like you would meet and you'd, you know, meet every few weeks and then you would go and you would talk to kids in the elementary schools and you'd say like, okay, so what is a stereotype? How do these form? How do we try and work past them? We were really talking about a lot of issues of diversity. And I didn't realize that that wasn't the case until I went away. And so I think like many people, after I'd been away for about 10 years, I started to look back on my own hometown with a slightly different perspective. I could see all the things about it that were really good and that I appreciated, and then also the things about it that are sort of weird and quirky, and that, again, I had thought were normal until I went away.
So by setting a book in a town that's actually doing things well, yeah, I mean, relatively well, that's being kind of conscious about race and teaching kids very different from its surroundings, like that's, you know, making an effort. And yet the thing that goes wrong is racial tension and sort of sublimated racial tension. What is the idea?
Like, why do that?
No, I mean, it seems important. Like, we do talk a lot now about, I mean, there is unconscious bias, like white privilege. There's sort of a lot of like, the people with the good intentions are the people that we shine the spotlight on. I mean, left a lot now. So I'm just curious, what motivated you to set it there as opposed to like one of the towns that didn't, conscious.
That was one of the things that I really wanted to explore, is sort of how far good intentions can take you and whether good intentions are a substitute for actual results, maybe. Shaker Heights, I think, does a lot of talking about this, but it still has problems with race. Even when I was there, which was in the 90s, I moved there when I was 10, and I stayed until college, there was still a lot of discussion. If you went into the cafeteria, you would see that the tables had basically self-segregated themselves. So there would be tables that were largely white kids and tables that were largely black kids. The same with classes. If you went into the AP classes, they were largely white. And if you went into sort of the college prep or like the sort of general classes, a lot of them were the students of color. And it was something that was, even with all of their efforts, was clearly, there was still a divide. And I wanted to kind of look at how, even when you have the best of intentions, that's sometimes not necessarily enough.
I'm curious about the responses you've gotten to that, especially from people from your hometown?
Yeah, I was really nervous about it because I was supposed to go to Shaker Heights at the beginning of book tour, and for scheduling reasons, it got bumped to the end. So it was the last stop on my book tour. And at every single stop before that, people would say, like every reading, someone said, "So what do the people in Shaker Heights think about your book?" And the more they asked it, the more nervous I got about it. And when I
Sorry for asking that.
No, it's the story has a sort of happy ending, I think, in that I was supposed to go and give this reading, and they said, "We actually had a lot of interest, and we have like 800 people lined up to come, and so we've moved it to the auditorium of the middle school," which is my middle school, where I last was when I was about
that is so 13. Weird.
It was very weird. The last time I had been there, I think it was in the orchestra, and I was standing in the aisle, and I had to play A Whole New World from Aladdin was the song.
Beautiful song. Performing. Were you like flooded with awkwardness?
Oh yeah, they had me in the green room, was backstage, and they had the desks that have the little chair, and the desk is attached to it, and I had to sit there in it, and I was again feeling like I was in middle school.
This
and then
is the subject of your next book.
I think so. It's the traumas that middle school inflicts on you. And then behind me was a shelf of all of these old textbooks, some of which I remembered from being in middle school. So it was like throwing me into the deep end of my teenage years. But the people in Shaker Heights mostly have seen the book, I think, the way I wanted it to be seen, which is as sort of a loving portrait of a place that I care about, that really shaped me, but that also is kind of honest about its blind spots, I think is what you were saying. That even though we're trying, we don't always necessarily get it right because we're humans. And I think in a lot of ways, that's a very Shaker Heights way of looking at things, which is like, we don't get it right, but we're going to keep trying. Like, we're very idealistic.
It's so Quaker. Like, I know you're a Catholic, but the whole scene is so Quaker, you know?
It's, yeah, the Shakers, we're a religious group kind of like...
Oh, it is the Shakers.
The Shakers,
yeah.
Shakers.
Yeah. Okay, got it. That's why.
I went into this rabbit hole of research, which any writers out there will know, you can spend a lot of time researching things, and you do, you know, a lot of research, and a very small amount of it actually works its way into the final product. But the Shakers never actually lived in Shaker Heights. They didn't found the community because one of their main tenets is celibacy. And so basically after a while, they died out. And Shaker Heights was built on the land where they used to live. But there's a lot about this sort of the philosophy of the Shakers, the religious group, that actually explained a lot about Shaker Heights to me, that they really were idealists. They were in a lot of ways really ahead of their time. They were progressive. They were basically communist. They believed in gender equality, and yet at the same time, they were also really kind of uptight, for lack of a better word. And that explains so much to me, because that's mm-hmm. very much sort of how I think about Shaker Heights, too, is being this weird combination of those two things.
So I know that a lot of book clubs in Shaker Heights and all over the country have read your book. I'm wondering what you think it is about your book that makes groups of people, maybe often groups of women, want to discuss it. Like, what makes a book, like, interesting to book clubs? Do you have any theories of the book club?
I think books that start conversations seem to be the main thing. It doesn't even have to be that everybody in the book club loves it. But I think there's something about a book asking questions that people answer in different ways, and that people sort of can map their own experiences onto and say, okay, I felt, you know, aligned with this character. And someone else will say, really? Because I really hated that character. I really was aligned with this character. I feel like what makes a good book club book is not actually, you know, does everyone care about it or love it, or are they interested in the subject, but just that there's something about it that sort of touches a nerve for them that makes them want to go and talk about it with other people. I don't know what it is about my book. It may be that one of the things that it's looking at is sort of this very big question about what makes a good mother. Mm-hmm. And that's a really this kind of electrified question. And it's one that I'm not sure there is a good answer for, but that we put a lot of weight on culturally.
Yeah. But it's also like race, motherhood, community,
class,
art. Yeah, also, I mean, sort of what the role of art is, mm-hmm. and
immigration. Like, there's just so much in that book to think about and chew over.
Yeah, and I know you're also a mother. Were you working through some questions yourself as you were writing?
I mean, yeah, I think that's sort of what happens in all of my work. It's not that I'm directly an analog of any of them, but that I have these questions about, you know, we've got two mothers, one who sort of is taking the more well-trodden path She works an office job and so on. And then there's this other mother who is kind of, she's sort of sacrificing a lot for her art. And she's sacrificing a lot of her child's future for her art, too. And as a person in the arts, I sort of wonder, you know, am I doing the right thing? Maybe I should stop going on book tour, coming to book festivals, and I should be home, you know, like making the cookies and making his lunch and enriching his afternoons after school. You know, it's that kind of push and pull that I think I'm still working out. Like, probably the next project will be working that out too.
Outside your novel, you waded into this just like such heated thing about Asian women, white men, marriages. This is a story you wrote in New York Magazine. This is really interesting. And can you just talk a little bit about just all of it?
Just
like,
what,
the people who hate the Asian women.
What was that?
And the harassment of the Asian men.
Yeah, like just, I guess I sort of chuckled when you said I waded into it, because it was less I waded into it and more that I felt I was standing well inland, and then this very large wave came and like splashed over me. How do I even explain this succinctly? So I've learned that, to my sort of dismay, there is a small but very vocal contingent of particularly Asian men who are very angry at a lot of Asian women, ostensibly because they are married to non-Asian men. So I'm married to a white man. And they periodically come at me on Twitter or elsewhere and call me terrible names and call me a race traitor and tell me that my son is going to grow up to become a shooter because, of course, he's going to be mentally imbalanced because I'm teaching him to hate his wife. I mean, really horrible stuff. And these emails will just sporadically pop into my inbox from my website, or I'll get messages on Twitter, just, you know, not relevant to anything, that just felt like emailing me that day. And so this has happened for a long time, and I was sort of startled by this because I don't think of myself as a person who hates Asian men. There are Asian men, you know, that I love dearly. But it's something that I hadn't expected to deal with. And fairly recently I got an email that was kind of vicious about my son, and I was frustrated and I put it on Twitter because it seemed like the goal of it was to make me be quiet, and I didn't feel like being quiet about it anymore. And a lot of Asian women came to me and said, actually, we've been harassed in similar ways, often by the same people. And a lot of black women came and said, actually, there's a similar dynamic that sometimes happens in the black community, and so on. And so I ended up writing this piece for New York Magazine because it seemed like something that nobody wanted to talk about. There was this shame of feeling like I must have done something wrong. You know, and I think that the roots of it really are misogynistic rather than racial, that it does seem to have this idea of, like, these are our women, and you're taking them from us.
And there's something that you owe.
There's something that we owe them, which generally has to do with sex and our bodies. Like, we owe it to them because, interestingly, these same Asian men are totally fine with Asian men dating white women.
So weird.
They have a lot of really complicated theories about why that's okay, but it's not okay for Asian women to date white men. And you can fill in for yourself what this is. And writing this article involved me going into the recesses of some very scary boards on Reddit, the internet discussion site, which I don't recommend to anybody. But it was interesting in doing this also to see that there were echoes in what a lot of these, you know, small subgroup of Asian men, most Asian men are not like this at all, but that they're using language that echoes that of white supremacists. They're talking about racial purity. They're talking about, they refer to whitewashing your genes and eugenics. And it was startling to me to think, as we've been talking about the culture that we're in now, that seems to be in the water right now, that feeling of, I don't even know what to call it.
Yeah, genetic purity or white supremacist. Or I think just the theories that originate with white
fear of being erased. I keep coming back to that chant from the Charlottesville, like, you will not replace us. It feels like resonant of whatever that sentiment
is. It is this fear that they're going to be, you know, bred out of existence. I read an interesting article recently about the rise of the far right in Germany, and that a lot of it maps very neatly into places in East Germany where there was a huge exodus of women for economic reasons, but that now a lot of the men who are in those areas, they're sometimes outnumbered like 2-1, are voting for the Alternative for Deutschland, which is the really far right part. And I think that you can't sort of separate out the issue of gender from all of these questions.
Wow, yeah.
That was very far-ranging. Sorry.
No, thank you so much for sharing. I think that's all the time we have. But please read Little Fires Everywhere. It's an excellent book. And thank you so much for your time, Celeste.
Thank you.
Great to talk to you. All right. Next up, we have Noreen's colleague, actually, Rebecca Traister. She's a writer at large at New York Magazine and a contributing editor at Elle. She's the author of Big Girls Don't Cry and All the Single Ladies, and most recently, Good and Mad, a book about the historical and political impact of women's anger. We are so psyched to have her on the show. Please welcome Rebecca Traister. Woo!
Thank you so much. I just want to immediately get back into the previous two conversations that you were having. I was sitting back there and I was like, oh, I want to talk about this. I want to talk about this.
You could have been like voice of God on a mic back there. Just
hello.
So your book is about women's anger. I've been feeling a little bit of that lately.
That's weird.
A little bit of women's
anger.
You're
definitely the only one.
I'm sure, yes. But reading your book, it made me feel like I was a part of something. But I have to say, the anger that I've been feeling around Brett Kavanaugh, and it comes in waves, you know. Some days I won't feel as angry about Trump. Some days I'll feel very angry about Trump. Some days I'll be furious about Me Too. Some days I'll be happy about Me Too. For me, it doesn't always feel powerful. It feels nauseating. It feels paralyzing. Sometimes it feels energizing and vital, but it's not a fun feeling. And you're telling us that, you know, it can be this fertilizer of the seeds of political and social change. So how do we take that? How have women taken that sort of nauseating part and made it the powerful part?
Well, in part, I think it's the intensity of the feeling. So the book, again, doesn't necessarily... My argument is not that the feeling of anger is inherently powerful and that you can immediately recognize your anger as the thing that's going to lead you to the forefront of a transformative social movement that we'll look back on as having altered the nation permanently. It's more like considering... my guess, and my book doesn't come at this exactly from a personal psychological perspective. Soraya Chomali's book, Rage Becomes Her, which was published a couple weeks before mine and is wonderful, tackles the sort of individual feeling of it, the nausea, the horror, the frustration. In part, that, I think, is tied up with the way that women's anger, often anger at inequity or injustice, you can feel like you're powerless, and you can also feel like the anger that you're feeling, you're weird for feeling it. It's going to fundamentally undermine you if you express it, because then you're just going to be that angry woman who nobody takes seriously, that you can't do anything with it. In part, it's that notion of paralysis, because women's anger is discouraged and censured and made marginal and framed as unattractive, especially for women of color, framed as threatening, that makes us feel like we can't take that anger and express it in the way that might just be normal, healthy, and human, to say, I'm incredibly pissed off about this. And then you might feel, and to have people listen to you and take it seriously and say, why? And then have that anger treated as diagnostic in the way that we are more likely to treat the anger of white men, for example, as politically diagnostic, right? That's one of the things that I noticed when I was writing this book in the midst of post-2016 coverage that told us again and again correctly that the anger of working class white men in the Midwest was something that politicians needed to take seriously. This is true. Why? Because it told us about the issues that needed to be addressed: unemployment, rampant drug addiction, lack of access to affordable health care, the drying up of certain professions. Right. Their anger was something that political campaigns and candidates had to have taken seriously, and if they didn't, it was a failure, because it pointed us to the things that are broken. And that's right. But we don't take the anger of other kinds of people and treat it as instructive in that same way. And so if we're feeling some of that anger that we know is not going to earn us a story, you know, on the front of the paper that says, why aren't we taking Christina's anger seriously and pointing us toward all the things that are broken, that can make us, that can be part of what feels corrosive and make us feel sick to our stomachs.
Yeah.
Do you feel like the anger around Me Too has not been taken seriously?
No, I think it has been. Yeah. I think one of the things that I'm sort of paying attention to is the fact that we are hearing women's anger differently for reasons that are complicated, because a lot of it is the anger of white suburban women or white wealthy women. And that was something that's really important about how the hashtag MeToo movement erupted in the fall of last year, is that it came from women who had risen to the top of a white patriarchal system by many measures, were wealthy.
Alyssa Milano, right?
Alyssa Milano, and Angelina Jolie and Gwyneth Paltrow and some of the women who initially told their stories about Harvey Weinstein having assaulted them. And it actually, I was thinking about it when you were talking about Sheryl Sandberg, and something that has been obsessing me is this notion of whether you tell women how to navigate through a white patriarchy and get to the top of it, and then what it means to have the revelation that even for those women who sort of win at white patriarchy, whether it's Gwyneth Paltrow, whether it's Hillary Clinton, whether it's Christine Blasey Ford, part of what we've seen over the past couple years is those women nonetheless being punished, oppressed, attacked, or losing within that white patriarchy.
You know, that is so interesting. The thing you said just totally crystallized it for me about how people take it seriously, and so they think they have to respond to it. I hear what you're saying about white women, but maybe it also has to do with the collective nature of it, because it's a thing that happened during Twitter, and so there was a collective anger, and what happens to women is, like, what happens to women and sort of how every woman feels like she has to, you know, figure out, work mother issues herself in the workplace. Like, there's this way in which every anger becomes individual and you are individually judged for anger, but something about the movement's instant collective nature made it impossible not to respond to in some way.
Right. Well, and I think that's actually one of the useful things about expressing anger. So many of the social and individual personal messages that we're taught from the time we're children and outside of necessarily political contexts is to not express our anger, right? That if we speak angrily, if we raise our voice, part of the things that I'm sure were in Lean In, if I remembered it clearly, which I don't. Like, if you raise your voice, if you're aggressive, then people are going to hear you differently. You might not get that raise. You might, if you're a woman of color and you get angry for being pulled over for nothing, you have every right to be angry. You take a terrible risk if you get mad at your arresting officer, right? There are very real penalties placed on women for expressing their anger. And then there are small social ones, like people are going to, you know, think you're a bitch. People are going to not want to be around you. They're not going to take you as seriously. We know that if Christine Blasey Ford had raised her voice in anger, she would have probably been arrested, right? Like, we can't even envision a world in which she could have responded to her questioners. But in the instances where anger or resistance or dissent is expressed, it can be incredibly connective for people. One of the reasons that I think the expression of women's anger is discouraged, the expression of anger of marginalized people, is because it, in addition to anger being divisive and sort of destructive, and it has those qualities, it can also be connective, because if you raise your voice in anger, then you become audible to other women who might feel angry about the same thing but have been thinking all this time that they were alone angry themselves. And that, I heard that process described over and over again. I write about this in the book. When I went to report last summer on the white suburban women in Atlanta, then organizing around the John Ossoff race, and many of them had been in these conservative communities where they had voted Democratic for a long time and were angry about things, but had kept it inside because they didn't want to be the skunk at the party. They didn't want to mess up the neighborhood dynamic. Everybody was conservative. They didn't even put lawn signs out. And they felt that their politics were weird. They felt that their anger was out of place. They sort of directed it inward. And then after the election, they got so mad that they couldn't keep it in anymore, and they kind of screamed or cried or whatever. And when they did, they realized that a woman two doors down was angry about the same thing, had been their neighbor for 30 years, and they'd never spoken about these things. But then they started talking, and then, like, they went to an Indivisible meeting, and then they have devoted every minute of their spare time ever since to not electing John Ossoff, but working for Stacey Abrams and Lucy McBath. And that has, so anger and the expression of it made them discernible to each other. And so anger can be connective and communicative in that it makes you feel less alone and part of a collective.
Although, as I was reading your book, I was thinking about a taxonomy of anger. Like, what anger is authentic? How is it channeled? How does Steve Bannon use it? How does the white working class is not, it was when there were unions, a collective anger coalesced and directed in a particular direction. That's not the white working class male anger now, because there isn't any union through which you can sort of direct it and channel it up. It's very individualistic, but what I feel like men are really good at theatrical, the theater of anger. Because when Brett Kavanaugh actually lost it, we were like, whoa, dude. Like,
we were.
Like, keep but that in we check.
Were. The people like, who supported him, and the same with Lindsey Graham. When Lindsey Graham responded to Brett Kavanaugh with anger, people who supported them were energized by that.
They needed him because his anger was the theatrical version of Brett Kavanaugh's real, he saved Brett Kavanaugh because he was doing theater of anger, which people are cool with men doing, but Brett Kavanaugh was like, no.
I think the force that intersects with these different kinds of anger and explains to some degree how they're useful and how is power. So the power of a white working class organizing in a labor movement is an anger that is directed at the more powerful, right? It's about an expansion of opportunity and challenging of a system that is depriving the people who are angry of something, right?
Right.
But the anger of a white working class right now, again, a community that is economically in trouble, and I'm not denying, but the actual direction of their anger isn't at the more powerful, it's not at the Republicans, it's not at the at capitalism, it's at it's actually they're taking an anger of the powerful about their status that has been challenged. They perceive that their status has been challenged.
I don't think they're doing anything. I'm just thinking about how their anger is manipulated. Like, their anger has been repackaged through InfoWars, right-wing sites, and Steve Bannon. And the narrative has been that's totally patronizing what I'm saying, but I actually think it's true that their anger has been taken and packaged and put into a story, which is sort of everywhere and picked up. It's not their own. In some weird way.
That's interesting.
I think that there are people who have bought perhaps a story fed to them by somebody else that, you know, an immigrant is taking their job, even though an immigrant hasn't taken their job has just been, you know, replaced to China. But I don't think that that's a false narrative necessarily. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, these people are speaking with their votes and they're voting for people like Ron DeSantis.
Mm-hmm. Has women's anger been packaged in that way? I mean, you could make an argument the sort of...
Okay. On the right, it has. Women's anger on behalf of a white patriarchy is absolutely, I mean, that's the Mama Grizzlies, right? Mm-hmm. Pretty much the only kind of women's anger that is broad. Now, we are in a period where we're celebrating, acknowledging, listening to women's anger differently. That's in part the thing that I'm writing the book about. That's the anger of Ana Maria Archila and Maria Gallagher in the elevator yelling at Jeff Flake was an anger that I think was received extremely warmly and very powerfully. It went viral. It channeled something for millions of women who were not in that elevator. And of course, it was the polar opposite of the kind of rhetorical range that was offered Christine Blasey Ford. But historically, the kind of women's anger that's been held up as a model of ferocity has been anger that's been deployed on behalf of fundamentally conservative, I would argue regressive, politics on behalf of a white patriarchy. So that's Mama Grizzlies. That's the anger of right-wing women. That's the anger of Fox News anchors who, you know, and
but is that anger or theater of anger?
Well, that's the question. We are asked to, I think sometimes right-wing anger is real anger. Phyllis Schlafly was genuinely angry at the disruptions to the sort of social order that had been made by second-wave feminism. I think, and she marshaled an army of, I think, also authentically angry white women to stop the ratification of the ERA. I think that a lot of the women... the white women who stood on the front lines and objected to the integration of schools were angry at the disruption of a social order. So I do think that some of that anger is real. Do I think that Sarah Palin was, remembering going to her rallies in 2008 and her talking about how Obama was going to take the guns and we had to, he's going to come into your house in the night and take your guns away. Yeah, I think there was some, was it anger?
Not fear. You don't think of that as fear.
I think it was playing on fear. Mm-hmm. But I think she was the way she was saying it is, I'm a real American and I'm going to make sure this doesn't happen. Mm.
When you talk about the women who yelled at Jeff Flake in the elevator, I had a reaction watching that was like, ooh, you know, like, oh my gosh, this is so uncomfortable for me to watch. I feel awkward. Like, I feel all the ways that the patriarchy has told me to feel about women's anger.
Do you guys know what we're talking about, by the way? Okay, cool.
I'm so glad to see so many nodding heads. And the video really did go viral. And I feel the same way sometimes when I see,
you think it's because it was in an elevator?
that part of it was that he looked
so
awkward, which
like
was the point.
In an elevator. Yes.
But I also think hearing like one or two people yelling and then sort of realizing that the subject of their anger is not walking away, so they have to think of more things to yell. Like, I just felt so uncomfortable watching. And I love the way you wrote in your book about the anger of Me Too exploding in unpredictable ways and unpredictable directions that can feel very unsafe as a woman who's invested in feminism for like self-interested reasons and also philosophical reasons. Like, where is this going? Are people being too angry? Should we have put names on the shitty media men list? Is that sort of volatility and unpredictability part of the power? Is that something that happens all of the time when people get angry?
So I make this argument in the book about how the challenge to power is perceived as disruptive, dangerous, because it is. That power operating in one direction is just power. But if somebody's going from the bottom and challenging the top, that's when we get talked about as a mob, as a witch hunt. And I feel the same way that
Wait,
you...
Wait, can you explain that? Sorry, I didn't understand that.
One more time. So one of the things that I've sort of become obsessed with, thinking about how challenge works or violence works, I actually first started thinking about it in 2015 when Freddie Gray was killed by police in Baltimore. He was an African-American man who was taken on a rough ride in a police van, and he later died from his injuries. And there were protests in response. And I, at the time, was writing a column, and I was reading all this coverage, and all the coverage said the violence began when protesters threw rocks. And that was a big sort of revelatory moment for me, because it was the first time that I understood how when violence, and this is distinct from anger, but I think related, that when violence happens in one direction, when it's the police who kill a black man in Baltimore, it's so normalized, actually. It's so part of how we understand power and power abuses to work that it's not even discernible as the commencement of violence. It's the throwing of the stones by people whose only power is to throw stones in that scenario that is comprehensible as disorder and disruption, and that's how the violence commences. Wait,
so you're saying we don't recognize structural things that happen within an accepted structure as violence, that like we don't recognize structural violence or violence that's like a police, is that what you're saying?
We normalize all kinds of things that happen when they come from the top down, various forms of abuse, punishment. We don't sort of bat our eyes at them, or if we do, you know, we might write critically about them in newspapers, but that the ease of caricaturizing something as violent, chaotic, disruptive. There's another example very recent, which is the way that the women screaming as they took the vote on Brett Kavanaugh was the mob, and we were all told that the backlash to that kind of it was a mob, and Donald Trump compared them to arsonists, and he wasn't alone. I had all the references a few weeks ago, right after it happened. I can't remember everybody who said everything. Somebody on Fox News called them screaming animals. It was a mob, and that was an instance in which this man who had been alleged to have committed a violent assault as a young man, but who also was being pushed through to sit on the court, to have enormous power, the only power that women had in that moment. They were being voted over. They were losing. The only power they had was to yell. But the very act of yelling was framed by politicians and by many in the media as risky, disordered, chaotic, scary. And lots of people, even in the left media, were like, oh my God, this is going to create a backlash because these angry protesters are going to be viewed negatively and the right is going to benefit from it. And there was a lot of commentary that suggested that that might happen because that was the disorder. And that was very true of Me Too. So all of the abuse that was being objected to was something that had just happened normally for mm-hmm. as long as there's been people in power. But when we started in radical ways to object to it, to yell about it, to put people's names on lists, it was dangerous because it was a reversal of how power is supposed to work. And the people, and it was, that's, then it was a witch hunt. Then it's every day of my life I get asked, is Me Too gone too far? And poor Matt Damon, what has happened to Matt Damon? Because people were very critical of Matt Damon on the internet after he said some condescending things about the Me Too movement. And everywhere I go, I mean, not everywhere, but many places I'm asked about, like, the horrors experienced by Matt Damon.
There goes my next question.
Sorry. because the challenge is so, like, when the people who have less power deploy it in dissent or resistance to the way a power structure typically works, it does create chaos. And the answer to the question that you asked many minutes ago is that I do think we need chaos, because I think if you want to change the system, I actually do think, and by many measures, I feel like an incrementalist within an electoral system. Like, I'm anxious about things like revolution, because I think the most vulnerable people are likely to suffer. But I also think that we need, like, if we don't create chaos and disorder, then it means that the system's staying intact, and it's the system that is built around all kinds of biases and inequities that many of us are objecting to.
One of my favorite moments in your book is actually when you talk about the fear of backlash, the fear that, you know, you quote Caitlin Flanagan at one point saying, and she's someone who is in favor of the Me Too movement, she's very afraid of exactly the scenario that, like, the anger will consume it. And then, this doesn't follow directly from that, but you sort of have a friend who calls you up after some positive electoral results, I think, and says, you know, maybe we're the backlash. Maybe what we're doing is the backlash against this culture. And I kind of love just that reframing. It actually helped me think through this a lot, because I have, too, just been, like, sitting on my hands waiting for it to come. And thinking about it this way is really helpful for me.
I think we often think of these things as distinct moments. And I do this too. Like, during Me Too, I was just waiting for the moment that Me Too ended and the backlash started. Like, there was going to be a solid break. And one of the things in learning the history that I have been writing about in recent years is that there's always forward motion and backward pressure at all times. And they're always working against each other. And we sort of tell ourselves neat lies about distinct periods and distinct victories, when in fact, the story of progress and alteration to this country's structure has been one that has been going on for 2+ centuries, and we are still engaged in the very same fights, even if we don't want to, the fights for full enfranchisement and bodily autonomy and equality and participation and representation. We are actually still engaged in these fights that have been going on for centuries, and we have these are pernicious lies we've told ourselves that those fights have been won.
I think that's all the time we have.
Thank you so much. It was so great to have you on.
Thank you.
We just have a couple minutes, so we're going to do our recommendations now.
Okay.
Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. I'm going to recommend, because I'm in Florida, Homecoming, which is the Amazon show based on a Gimlet podcast. It has fabulous characters played by Sissy Spacek and Julia Roberts. But one of the great characters in the show is Florida, which sneaks into the show as this very, like, a bird will suddenly fly through the window. But the main thing about Florida is that Florida looks like a government conspiracy, or at least they can make Florida look like a government conspiracy. Like, it's this weird fake place that the government erected, and you don't know where you are, and you're in some anonymous office park or something. So sorry if that's insulting, but it is this weird air that rises up in the show, which is, like, incredibly effective and critical part of how that show works. So it's very
Sounds
interesting.
Really good. Yeah. Noreen?
Well, first, I want to give a shout out to our super fan, Jan, who's
oh, yeah,
in the audience.
Jan.
Thank you for coming.
Jan.
And then my recommendation is a new album by the Pistol Annies called Interstate Gospel. So the Pistol Annies are, like, a country supergroup. It's Miranda Lambert and this woman, Ashley Monroe, and a third woman who I feel very badly because I cannot remember her name. She's a little less famous. and it's just, if you like Kacey Musgraves, it's sort of in that vein of country music, except Kacey Musgraves feels a little, at this point, a little twee to me, and the Pistol Annies are, like, really just like down home country. They're singing about their pill addictions. It's like the country melodrama, but through a 2018 lens. And it's just really fun music. It's especially fun music to drive to. So if you're driving somewhere for the holidays, the Pistolianis.
I am going to recommend an article from the November issue of Smithsonian Magazine. You can also access it at smithsonianmag.com. It's called Becoming Anne Frank. You've read it. Oh, good. Yeah, I highly recommend it. It's a really sort of challenging piece about how the diary of Anne Frank became sort of the Holocaust narrative that everybody clung to, and why it was more appealing to the general public than tales of the Holocaust from people who had written about the concentration camps. It was extremely challenging to me as a person who, you know, thinks a lot about anti-Semitism these days. It seems to be resurgent in the U.S. and around the world, and the article, I think, did a really good job of complicating the forces that elevated her story above all others. I had never read something like that before that was critical of that, and also of the organization that runs the Anne Frank House in Denmark. So yeah, Smithsonian Magazine, Becoming Anne Frank is the name of the article. That's all the time we have. I really want to thank you guys for coming. You've been such a great audience.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you so much to the Miami Book Fair for having us, and to Lizette for putting this all in motion. Thank you to Celeste Ng and Rebecca Tracer for their time and their amazing writing. Thank you to our producer, Danielle Hewitt, our production assistant, Alex Barish, our on-site producer, Daniel Schrader. And for Hannah Rosen and Noreen Malone, I'm Christina Cotterucci. Thank you for listening.